Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been following the terrible flooding in the Midwest here in the U.S., but there's also a natural disaster still unfolding in Southeast Africa that's truly cataclysmic. Entire villages wiped out, roads destroyed, major cities underwater. The death toll from Cyclone Idai, which struck Mozambique and neighboring Zimbabwe last Thursday, continues to rise. Estimates now top 1,000 dead, but the final number may never be known. Hundreds of thousands of people are at risk of not having enough food or drowning. Claudia Aguilar is with Doctors Without Borders. She's on a cell phone in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. And Claudia, you're about 400 miles south of the area that suffered the most damage around the city of Beira. What are you hearing from there?
What we have been seeing is that 90% of the area around Beira has been destroyed. The main roads leading to Beira have been cut off. The water of the rivers are too high going over bridges, or there's damage in the roads that the cars cannot pass. Buildings extremely damaged, areas completely submerged. Rescue teams are on efforts of getting people over the roofs and tree houses. There is no power still in the city, and nearly all the communication lines have been cut since this morning. Communication has been starting to get better, not reliable yet, but better. But you can foresee that in that situation, it's really hard to assess the needs.
We heard that shipping containers were moved around like little Lego toys. This cyclone was just ferocious. What are people there saying? I mean, what are people who experienced this saying?
There's a lot of water, places completely submerged, and it still was ongoing. It's still raining. So, yes, the major part of the cyclone has hit, but the waters are still high. Their floodings are still high. It's still raining in Beira.
Oh, boy.
So we are, as MSF, we are doing assessments, trying to find the best areas to cover needs, seeing what are the most needed to respond to them. But you have to understand that this is still ongoing.
Yeah.
We already started to provide some assistance, but as we provide assistance, we still assess too.
Yeah.
The hostel is still partially functioning. It saw over 1,500 people in the first days of injured. As you said before, the toll rise is still upcoming. There's 202 confirmed deaths, but the president already even spoke about over 1,000 deaths.
There's one town, Buzi, is it? 200,000 people. It could become submerged. I mean, what will these people do? Where will they go?
Buzi is definitely one of the main affected areas. There is air assessments talking about very high levels of water, meters. The rescue operation is still ongoing.
Yeah.
Our main worries, of course, it's with the aftermath. We are worried about possible waterborne diseases and airborne diseases. You have a lot of people going into temporary accommodations and IDP camps, and you have a high concentration of people in a small area, so of course you worry about airborne diseases.
Yeah.
You have people fixing their houses, their roofs. Most people lost their roofs, and it's still raining. So you have people fixing the roofs, and they're still raining. The water supply in the city has not been restored, so waterborne diseases are very likely.
Yeah. Well, and looking ahead, I mean, these are people who live largely by what they can do, including growing crops. It doesn't seem as if that's something they're going to be able to do in the spring. It just seems pretty awful there.
It does. The emergency overall in the country is targeting every area. We are focused on the health part, of course, and water and sanitation, which is our expertise. But shelter has been one of the main priorities. Agricultural has been discussed in this coordination meeting.
Yeah. We're reading people, for instance, from the Red Cross, from other organizations, the African Union Commission, saying that they're doubling, tripling, quadrupling whatever they were planning in terms of aid because it's so much larger than anyone could have anticipated. Are you hearing that as well?
Yeah, that's similar to what we've been hearing. And to be honest, with all that, the previous two, before the cyclone impact, nobody had a clear idea of how big this would be. And as I said, the rain is still going. The dams are still full. The rivers are still overflowing. So even though the cyclone hit already almost a week ago, this is still happening.
Well, thanks.
So it's really hard to say about the impact when something is still unfolding.
Yeah. Dams still breaking, roads still washing away, and yet Doctors Without Borders is there. Claudia Aguiar with Doctors Without Borders, speaking to us from Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
The Trump administration continues to keep the pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Here's President Trump yesterday at the White House standing next to Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro.
We really haven't done the really tough sanctions yet. We can do the tough sanctions and all options are open, so we may be doing that. But we haven't done the toughest of sanctions, as you know. We've done, right down the middle.
Many U.S. allies in Latin America are standing side by side with the U.S. support of the Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido and his effort to oust Maduro. But there are some exceptions. Mexico has remained neutral in the dispute. Rodrigo Cervantes of member station KJZZ reports from Mexico City.
It's lunchtime in Mexico City and tasty Venezuelan dishes arrive to the tables of Orale Arepa. Luis Rojas manages the restaurant, which has an unbeatable location.
Next to the Venezuela embassy, I think it's working pretty good.
Rojas moved from his homeland 5 years ago to the country where his family lives now.
We live here in Mexico like we used to do in the 90s in Venezuela. So we feel very comfortable here.
Rojas says since President Nicolás Maduro took power, more Venezuelans have moved to Mexico. And he can tell from the growing lines of people outside the embassy. The Venezuelan embassy declined a request for an interview, but data from the Mexican government show that Rojas might be right. The largest group of foreigners in Mexico requesting or renewing residence cards in 2018 were from Venezuela. That's almost 20,000 people. And 73% of resident refugees in Mexico come from Venezuela, followed by Salvadorans and Hondurans. In fact, from 2017 to 2018, the number of Venezuelan refugee residents increased from almost 800 to nearly 3,000.
People don't believe, but it's no food, no security. The basic things that you take for granted, we don't have it in Venezuela.
Rojas says President Donald Trump did the right thing by recognizing opposition leader Juan Guaido as interim president of Venezuela. And while Rojas is happy in Mexico, he's disappointed with the government's neutrality.
What I would like for Mexico is to change their mind and help us a little bit, you know, to get involved.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, stated that Mexico would support a peaceful, negotiated solution in Venezuela, following the principle of non-interventionism.
I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think that's going to be of any help.
That's Macario Schettino, political analyst and researcher at the Tec de Monterrey College in Mexico City. And he says AMLO tries to emulate a Mexico from the past century, with its closer ties to Latin America than to the United States.
He thinks that defending the autocrats of Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, he's going to separate from the U.S.
Critics like Schettino see Mexico's position as lukewarm or even as a pat on Maduro's back, particularly as other countries, including Colombia, Argentina, Brazil, and Canada, joined the U.S. in support of the opposition leader. But many others applaud Mexico's stance and consider it righteous or even brave against U.S. domination.
Why did Mexico take that stand to appeal to what they consider left here in Mexico to a certain segment that questions whether Venezuela is really that bad off?
That's Amy Glover, an analyst and CEO of Spaceite, a global emerging markets consulting firm. She thinks AMLO is focusing more on domestic policies and is not interested in engaging in a diplomatic conflict with the U.S. Glover says Mexico's position with Venezuela is a rhetorical stance similar to the one it took with Cuba decades ago, in which it kept its relationship with the communist government despite the U.S. embargo. Glover says Mexico and the U.S. probably had a conversation to agree on their positions before going public.
And the less said, the better publicly. I have a feeling that that was what was ironed out.
Hundreds gathered in Mexico City in late February to support Guaido and ask Mexico to respond to the food crisis in Venezuela. Juan Aguilera is a Venezuelan immigrant and one of the organizers.
No tiene nada que ver con política, ya es un tema humano.
Aguilera says the humanitarian crisis already goes beyond politics and political stances.
De hecho, yo creo que Andrés Manuel López Obrador llegó al gobierno como un defensor de derechos humanos.
He says AMLO was elected because he was seen as a human rights defender, and he hopes the president breaks his silent alliance with Maduro.
Se ha demostrado que los pueblos no son los gobiernos. Los pueblos, cada pueblo tiene su propia voluntad.
But Aguilera says that at the end of the day, it's the people and not the governments who make the difference. For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
President Trump visits an army tank factory in Ohio today, a politically fraught visit. 2 years ago, Trump campaigned in the state promising that manufacturing jobs were coming back. He won the state handily, but now GM jobs are leaving. Ohio's Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown has accused the president of not doing enough to stop the closure of that GM factory in Lordstown earlier this month.
Lots to discuss with our political strategist, Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
And Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and host at Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Hello. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday. Okay, so over the weekend, President Trump tweeted that GM CEO Mary Barra must act quickly to reopen the plant in Lordstown, Ohio. This is the plant, by the way, that made the Chevy Cruze, and a lot of people are moving to bigger cars, and so GM decided that it would close that plant. The president said the head of the local union should stop complaining and get the job done. Matt, as you look at the president and how much he's been focused on this, is he worried about losing support in Ohio?
Well, I think he's worried about the perception that, you know, his promise that manufacturing would come back is not being realized across the country. Now, the reality is that you've had about a half million manufacturing jobs created in the first 26 months of the president's administration. But, you know, obviously he's taken U.S. automakers incredibly seriously. He engages with them directly. He wants to see them succeed. He wants to see manufacturing come back. In this case, you know, GM has some unique problems. This is obviously a labor dispute. He's generally been on pretty good terms with the labor unions. He just doesn't want to see manufacturing slide in the United States, and he's much more proactive than most presidents are, and there are good aspects to that and bad aspects to that.
And Jamal, the presidential candidate, former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, actually made a surprise visit this week to the Lordstown GM plant. He spoke about it with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Here he is.
The one thing I wouldn't do is what we just saw the President of the United States do, which is to add insult to injury, demean those workers, insult the union president. At the time that they're losing more than 14,000 jobs, he's laying the blame at their feet. Absolutely counterproductive and insulting, if you ask me.
Jamal, what do you think Democrats should do here?
Well, one, Democrat shouldn't let the president get away with trying to blame this on the unions. I mean, the one thing that I think is clear is what's happening in the macroeconomic sense is that people are moving away from small cars, and there's more robotics and more AI and more software that is taking the place of much of the human labor that went into this. I'm from Michigan. I have watched this my entire life. I've seen this trend take place. So Democrats also then have to prepare workers for the new reality,
right,
where they're going to have to work in software and AI and robotics and not be looking for economic style that the American economy is just not built for anymore.
It's tricky. It's a tricky needle to thread there because they can't be saying these jobs will come back or they'll bring them back if they were in charge because they might not be able to. But I'm going to pivot to this Twitter feud between President Trump and George Conway, the husband of Trump counselor Kellyanne Conway. A lot of people around here, you know, asking, why should we care about this? I want your opinion about this. This morning on Twitter, Trump called George Conway a stone cold loser and husband from hell. And we know, of course, George Conway had, you know, over the weekend said that people should pay, you know, start paying attention to the president's mental health. George Conway tweeted back today, you, period, are, period, nuts. Look, Matt, you know, some people are saying this is just distraction. Others are saying, look, this is important. Is somebody really trying to tell us, someone from an inner circle, that this president is not well?
Yeah, I mean, George Conway really hasn't been on the inside. He did work at the Justice Department for a very short period of time.
He sleeps in the same bedroom as Kellyanne Conway.
Right. It's pretty clear, though, that, the husband and wife have very different views about this president. So I doubt they're, you know, in pillow talk, you know, sharing secrets about what they really think about what's really happening. I don't think it matters that much. You know, I don't think George Conway has a medical degree. He's not in a position to give any type of diagnosis. You know, I wish the president didn't feel the need to feud publicly with so many people, but he obviously likes to counterpunch, particularly when he's attacked. And in this case, Conway's been attacking him and questioning his mental capacity for some time, and really the president didn't respond until very, very recently out of respect for Kellyanne. So it is an awkward situation when you have a husband and a wife in that kind of different perspective.
Well, but he did tweet, Jamal, after a weekend of, what was it, 50 tweets from the president on, you know, some of the smallest, most spiteful things. Do you think this counts, this Conway back and forth?
Here's what we know. What we know is that the president of the United States feels free to not tell the truth. The Washington Post chronicles it every almost day, it seems like, when the president is saying things that are not true. And the president himself, when confronted about whether or not he helped draft a statement on Air Force One counteracting a Russian meeting, basically said it was just the failing New York Times. Who cares if I lie talking, you know, to them? So we know the president doesn't tell the truth. We know the president is erratic. I mean, 50 tweets from anybody in a course of 2 days is not normal. I'm not a medical doctor, but I do know that's not normal. And I do know that where we are as a country with a president that tells so many untruths that we just don't know what is true is a very dangerous place, because when we need the president to lead us and tell us something about we're going to have to do to buckle up and to do something hard, we don't have the confidence in this leader that he is the person we should listen to in that moment.
There is one attack that he went on over the weekend that I think we should talk about, especially because there's a Republican senator who is
He's talking about it today,
and that's Johnny Isaacson. So President Trump had gone after multiple times Senator John McCain, the late Senator John McCain, who died from brain cancer. And Republican Johnny Isaacson said to a conservative news site that the country deserves better. The McCain family deserves better. I don't care if he's president of the United States, owns all the real estate in New York, or is building the greatest immigration system in the world. Matt, what do you think of these attacks from President Trump on John McCain?
Yeah, I think they're unnecessary. You know, he's been dead for months now. You know, he cast a controversial vote for Republicans in voting against the Senate's version of the repeal bill of Obamacare. That was obviously a controversial vote, at least within the Republican Party. I don't understand why he feels the need to continue to go after him. It doesn't really benefit him. Now, I will say, I think you can separate John McCain's honorable public service to this country and his military service and his POW status with his political decisions. And so I think you can criticize a decision to vote for or against a particular piece of legislation. I wish he would keep it, you know, in the substantive realm, not into the name-calling realm. So I don't understand why he goes after him. That said, you know, in the Republican Party, there is still some frustration with that McCain vote and with some other positions he had, you know, on policy issues. I just don't see what it benefits him. For some reason, he sees a need to continue going after him. I wish he'd stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that he goes after him for that vote in particular, because there are a number of Republicans who are still in the Senate who have voted against some key pieces of Trump legislation or nominees that he's made, and he doesn't go after them in the same way. Just in the few minutes we have left here, why don't we talk a little bit about 2020, because there's a lot going on there. This is, you know, it's been a big week for Beto O'Rourke, Jamal, but also Elizabeth Warren saying she wants to get rid of the Electoral College. What stands out to you in the last week?
Oh, what's clear to me, I think if we could mash up these candidates, we would have a super juggernaut. Elizabeth Warren is running the most positive policy campaign of anybody on the Democratic stage. She comes out with something new just about every week or so, where she lays out a new big idea, like breaking up tech companies. Obviously, we know she wanted to go after the banks. She's talking about the Electoral College. Mayor Pete Buttigieg has got just such a great message about rationality. It's amazing. He's like the most mature candidate in the race. He's the youngest person running, and he has such a maturity about himself. And then there's Beto O'Rourke, who's a social media native, and he is probably pound for pound the best natural talent running on the Democratic side. And Kamala Harris, who is as inspirational and a tough prosecutor and has gone after people and gives a lot of hope to a lot of Americans who want to see something new. I just think this is such a great field, and I'm excited about it every single day.
You know, Matt Mikowiak, I know you want to weigh in on the Democrats who are jumping into the race increasingly, very crowded field. That phrase is going to get a very crowded field. But I just want to pivot back for just a second. You know, we were talking about the president's Twitter attacks and his back and forth now with George Conway. This was all happening when we're not hearing from the president of the United States about climate change and we have severe extreme weather. We're not hearing about troops overseas in combat. We're not hearing about our closest ally, Britain, falling apart except for a nasty editorial that his son wrote criticizing Theresa May in a British paper. We're not hearing about an attack on Muslims in New Zealand except when he's asked by the press. When we have the leader of New Zealand calling for a moment of prayer for the victims, and they're going to play the Muslim call to prayer across the country, doesn't this president feel, with all those huge issues we need to hear about, feel small?
Well, look, I think he's not played the role of president in the way that the previous presidents have. He hasn't felt a need to reassure the nation on some things, particularly things like, you know, natural disasters in some cases. He's just very focused on his agenda, on what he promised the voters, much of which he's accomplished, much of which he's still working on. He's very focused on trade. Obviously, there's some news today on China that they may not remove the tariffs unless not only the China deal occurs, but that China is verified to be living up to their end of the bargain. So, look, he's just very focused on the issues that he's working on, not necessarily these other things. And, you know, in the past, presidents of the United States have been in a position where they felt like they had to comment on all kinds of issues all the time. He really kind of picks and chooses. He doesn't weigh in on some things. He weighs in too much on others. Obviously, he's focused on the next year and a half and what he can get done.
That's Matt. Okay, Jamal, we don't have time, but I hear you.
I know. I know. I can't take it, though. Y'all have a good day.
Matt Mikowiak, the Republican strategist. Thank you both.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And we have news today of the first ever drug specifically for the relief of postpartum depression. That seems impossible that it's the first, given that 1 in 9 mothers suffer the syndrome after childbirth. But the FDA has approved Zulresso to treat various symptoms of PPD, ranging from depression and feeling overwhelmed to suicidal thoughts. Dr. Samantha Meltzer Brody is a professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She was the lead researcher in the clinical trials for this drug. So, Dr. Meltzer Brody, help us understand, how has postpartum depression traditionally been treated?
Well, thanks for having me today. So postpartum depression has traditionally been treated with either psychotherapy or with standard antidepressants. And while both of those could be effective in many women, both psychotherapy and standard antidepressant therapy can take 4 to 6 weeks or longer to work. Yeah. And so for new moms who are struggling, the postpartum period is such a difficult time. So there's been a great need for new treatments that act rapidly.
Yeah, especially since one of the symptoms can be a feeling of distance from that newborn, and you really want to take care of that fast. So how does this new drug work differently?
The new drug works differently because it is a formulation of allopregnanolone, which is a breakdown product of progesterone, one of the common female hormones. Progesterone is very high in pregnancy, falls rapidly postpartum. There's been interest for years in the fact that it could have potentially antidepressant and anti-anxiety properties. When we had the chance to study it for the first time as an open label drug at UNC going on 5 years ago, in the first patients, there was rapid and robust response to the medication within the first 24 hours of a 60-hour infusion. So it's just been a really, really interesting and exciting step forward for women's mental health.
Well, as you said, very exciting news, considering how terrible this syndrome can be. But there are some questions. It's expensive, about $34,000 per patient. It's infused, we understand, over 60 hours. And the patient would be kept in a medical center for safety there, because we understand there were some side effects, like, you know, women passing out. So, What kind of roadblocks are those? Is insurance going to pick up that cost?
Great question. So I certainly hope insurance will pick up the cost. And I think that all new drugs are very expensive. The commercialization aspect, I know, is something that Sage Therapeutics has been working on. And I think this is really a breakthrough therapy. To be able to quickly relieve symptoms will have huge economic positive impact. When you think about women that struggle for months or longer or unable to work. And I think that, you know, it is certainly going to be a treatment for women with more moderate to severe symptoms because it is an IV infusion. But for many women, if you say within 60 hours, you will no longer have these symptoms or they will be almost gone, that is really life-changing.
Well, Dr. Samantha Meltzer Brody, professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where they undertook these clinical trials for the new drug just for the relief of postpartum depression. We will certainly be watching this story. Dr. Meltzer Brody, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for your interest in the story. Great to talk.
And by the way, stock in Sage Therapeutics, that's the company that developed the drug, has risen 5% since yesterday's announcement. They say Zulresso could be commercially available as soon as June of this year. Hopefully, the insurance question will be straightened out.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Joni Deutsch is a DJ at WFAE, Charlotte's NPR station. She also hosts the podcast Amplifier. Joni, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And let's first of all talk about Charlotte. You're going to be bringing us music from Charlotte today, and it's not all the same thing. This runs the gamut.
It does. And, you know, I think that just shows the diversity of thought and sound in Charlotte. You know, we're more than a banking city. We're more than a football city. Go Panthers. We are also a music city. And I think today's selection will show a little bit of that.
But not a music city like Nashville, the music city. I mean, is it mainly country or is it all kinds of stuff?
It's all kinds of stuff. And I think there's a lot of history to it, too, that not a lot of people know about. I mean, you know, that banjo riff from Deliverance, the film? That was done by the guy who's from Charlotte, Arthur Guitar Boogie Smith. And actually, he made the first commercial recording studio in the Southeast in Charlotte, which is the same one that James Brown recorded Papa's Got a Brand New Bag in Charlotte. Yeah. So lots of history here.
Well, let's listen to some of the ones you brought us. This is called Up All Night. It's by Jason Jett. I'm thinking her and I'm describing me. Tell us more about this one.
Yeah, so this is from Jason Jett. He's a neo R&B singer, and you can hear a little bit of his influences there, Earth, Wind & Fire, maybe some Kool & the Gang and some Childish Gambino. And that song comes from his sophomore release, The Great Escape. I just love boogieing to it.
And Jason has been called the next big thing out of Charlotte by another native son, Anthony Hamilton. Are there other big names that have come out of Charlotte?
Oh, yeah, a few of them. I mean, actually, we're going to be hearing from one later, but there's been a lot of rockers that have come from the Charlotte area. Fetchin' Bones, the band, the Sponge Tones. So it's hard to say if Charlotte is known for one genre. I think we just have a bit of everything here.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is called Old Bones. This is by Sinners and Saints.
Me and Molly J fell in love one day. We were looking for a place to go home. We settled on a shack with a porch in the back and a little bitty puppy named Bones. We taught him how to sit and we taught him how to lay in his little bitty bed in a room. But all he ever did was cry all day and at night he'd howl at the moon. It ain't right what you're doing. It ain't right what you did. It ain't right how you're treating me. That I'll never get any sleep at night.
Okay, not what I thought that song was going to be about, but kind of cute.
It's not a country song unless a dog stays by your side as your partner leaves you, Jeremy. No, this is actually by the band Sinners and Saints, and one of the two in the band, Harry Fowler, he actually owns one of the best and most beloved venues for live music in Charlotte called Petra's. So he has a stake in the game, not just his venue, but his sound, too.
Now, Charlotte is not that far from Appalachia, but you wouldn't call it Appalachia, right?
You know, a debate. It's very debatable. I'm from West Virginia, so that is the core of Appalachia there. Charlotte, yeah, sometimes it's in Appalachia, sometimes it's not. I guess it depends on what music you're listening to.
But you
to.
Can hear a little bit of it right there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is Ojos Bobolos. This is by Chocola. From the more picante part of Charlotte, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little spicy. No, yeah. It is, though. It's by this band Chocola. They represent, you know, one of the newest parts of the music community, the Latinx community. But actually, there was an NPR piece that came out a few years ago, early 2000s, that called it the golden age of rock en español being in Charlotte. And I think Chocola is one of the bands really bringing that back, especially with the song. I mean, it really talks about equality and diversity and why it's more than the color of your skin or where you're from that defines who you are.
And two of the band members are siblings, Claudio and Lisa Ortiz. Have you seen them perform?
Yes, and actually they are amazing. It is hard not to get up out of your seat and start doing a little salsa or a little dance along with them. They're great live.
Okay, the next one you brought us is a new release from Emily Sage. This is called Nearer to You. That's very nice and kind of cinematic.
Yes, I would call it cinematic jazz, definitely. And it's just, it's beautiful. And she's originally from Portugal, but she moved to Charlotte in recent years. And this is where she's making that music. And she's also doing house shows now. She's combining the talents of herself and other up-and-coming artists in the community to showcase this new sound that's emerging. I love it. I love
you
it.
You know, it's interesting that she's from Portugal. We just had a DJ on recently who also brought us a number of artists with connection to Portugal.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe that's the next big thing.
The hot place to be. Okay, last but not least, you have brought us Dance Party with Cats. This is by the band It's Snakes. Make it time. Everybody loves their pets in Charlotte, I guess. As they should.
Actually, this is what the theme of the day is. It's pets. This is from It's Snakes, the lead singer you're just hearing from her, Hope Nichols. She's been a native to Charlotte now for more than 3 decades, contributing to the Charlotte music scene. And originally she was part of the band Fetchin' Bones, who had a big following in the mid and late 80s, touring with R.E.M., the B-52s, being on MTV when MTV was the thing. And she's still here. She's still a fixture of the community, and you can hear it in her voice. She loves what she does.
You call her the godmother of Charlotte rock.
I do. I believe in that, truly.
Why is that?
I think because she represents what Charlotte music and Charlotte rock can be, that you do not need to leave the area to be able to make the music you want to make. And that's what she embodies. She is rock and roll to the core, and her songs speak for themselves.
Okay, I know that you're here to talk to us about music, but while we have you, the best barbecue in Charlotte is...
Ooh, Jeremy, I don't know if I can do that.
Give it a try.
Maybe Plaza Midwood Smokehouse? Midwood Smokehouse, maybe. That's where all the celebrities go when Justin Timberlake comes to town. That's where he goes.
Well, if it's good enough for Justin Timberlake. Joni Deutsch, DJ at WFAE in Charlotte, also host of the podcast Amplifier. Joni, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And if you want to hear more, just go to our Spotify playlist. We are NPR Here and Now. Also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The Pentagon is disputing a new report from Amnesty International, which claims that civilians are being killed in Somalia by U.S. airstrikes targeting the Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab, which has links to Al-Qaeda. The Department of Defense released a statement that says there have been no civilian deaths. Citing intelligence, it says non-military organizations like Amnesty International don't have access to. Well, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with Amnesty International's Brian Kastner, weapons advisor for the group's international crisis team, and asked him for the top-line finding in today's report.
The top line is that AFRICOM has been saying for 2 years that zero civilians have died in their airstrikes in Somalia. And this is despite the fact that the number of airstrikes has really ramped up, tripled in 2017, went up from there. We're on pace for 140 or so in 2019. And so despite this real ramp up in attacks, they keep reporting that zero civilians have died and all of their strikes have been perfect. It doesn't pass a basic test there. Nobody's perfect, especially in war. We investigated the area right around Mogadishu. We had very limited access. But in 5 of the strikes that we were able to really nail down, we identified 14 civilian dead and 8 injured.
Your research shows that essentially 2 things are happening. Number one, that civilians are killed when they are nearby suspected terrorists. And number two, that civilians are killed when they are simply mistaken as terrorists. Can you tell me about one of those situations in which one of those things happened?
Absolutely. There's actually a case where those kind of things intersect. There was a case in Gobale, which is a little town about 75 kilometers north of Mogadishu, and there was a car driving down the road. This was August of last year, and there was probably an Al-Shabaab, suspected Al-Shabaab, you know, member inside the vehicle, but there were 3 other men in the vehicle as well. 2 of them were there to dig a well. One of them was worked for a Hormuz telecommunications company. He worked for the mobile phone company. And then there was a strike on that vehicle. And, you know, the target was probably the Al-Shabaab member inside. But the 3 other men, because they were with a known Al-Shabaab member, were presumed to be part of the group themselves. And so when AFRICOM reports that, they report it as 4 terrorists killed. Mm. And we reported as 1 terrorist killed and 3 civilians. And this is how the civilians just get wrapped up. And this is also how AFRICOM tells Congress that they killed 0 civilians, is it's the classification of who these men are. And then in some cases, you know, there's women and children that are nearby, and that's just not being reported by AFRICOM at all.
The strikes are being carried out by what? Drones, manned aircraft?
It's a combination, actually, and that was one of our findings as well. There are some new weapons that the U.S. is employing that we have seen used for the first time in my work. I look at bomb scrap from all over the world, and I had never seen these weapons before. One of them is a GBU-69, which is a type of weapon that flies a very long distance to its target and flies very, very quietly. And it doesn't come off a drone. It comes off of an AC-130 gunship, which is a kind of airframe that is normally used to support infantry. It's an escalation of the conflict. It's not just it's not just one strike here and there. The numbers is ramped up in the weapons as well.
The escalation has been happening since April 2017 as the U.S. has ramped up its fight against al-Shabaab. What can you tell us about how or why that priority has shifted in the White House?
I'm not sure I can tell you that I know exactly what's going through everybody's head there, but I would say this. Our reporting indicates that there was a move to declare Somalia an area of active hostilities, is what they call it, basically to apply war zone rules to Somalia. But in March of 2017, the president did sign a new directive and basically changed the rules and lowered the protection for civilians and allowed far more strikes than normally would have been allowed, and because civilians were allowed to be closer or categorized in different ways. And it's also true that as the fight against ISIS kind of began to tone down in Syria and Iraq, and as new weapons became available, this is where the AC-130s, we think, came from, is that once they weren't needed up there, they were directed to Somalia.
Of course, the context behind all this is that the Trump administration is consistently saying it wants to extract military operations from places around the world, Syria and Afghanistan, and yet U.S. government is ramping up in Somalia. So what are you calling on the government to do?
Well, first and most importantly is admit reality. Do the investigations into the five strikes that we were able to do. Do investigations into the 95 or 100 other strikes that have happened. And where civilians have been killed and it's a war and this happens, then they should say so. They should stop gaslighting a country and saying that this stuff is not happening. You know, we sit down in Mogadishu with these families, and the official U.S. government response to these families is either your loved one didn't die or they were al-Shabaab when they really weren't. And so the U.S. should investigate each of these cases and bring justice and, you know, recognize the victims.
Brian Kastner, Amnesty International's Senior Crisis Advisor on Arms and Military Operation. Thanks for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Brian Kastner spoke with Here Now's Peter O'Dowd. Again, the Pentagon said today, no civilians are being killed by U.S. airstrikes against al-Shabaab. We'll follow this story. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.